Hello and welcome back to New Books in Jewish Studies. I'm your host, Moses Lappin, and today I'm joined by Professor Luis Cortest for a discussion about his new book, Philo's Heirs, Moses Maimonides and Thomas Aquinas, published by Academic Studies Press in 2017. Professor Cortest is professor of medieval Spanish literature at the University of Oklahoma. The tensions between reason and revelation, between the Hebrew Bible and Greek philosophy, were central to pre-modern philosophy, and in a sense remain so today. We live in a world beholden to both religious and the secular as ways of understanding ourselves and the world around us. When and how did this begin? In his ambitious studies, Professor Cortest forcefully argues that at the center of this tradition stands the writings of Philo Judaeus, a Hellenistic philosopher who lived in Alexandria in the first century. Long forgotten and marginalized, in Philo, Cortest finds a method of thinking and a set of questions that he argues came to dominate the course of medieval philosophy. Although he was not quoted directly, Philo's Heirs uncovers a subtle genealogy from Philo to Moses Maimonides and Thomas Aquinas through the Church Fathers and Islamic Neoplatonic philosophy. The central chapters of the book focus on a comparison of Aquinas and Maimonides on the themes of metaphysics and divine attributes, on creation, divine providence, natural law, and prophecy. In each case, Cortest finds a synthesis of Greek philosophy and the Bible that had its origins in the writings of Philo. Philo's Heirs reframes these topics, asking us to think again about the long history of philosophy in the West and our debts to both the Greeks and to the Bible. More profoundly, it forces us to ask about the ways in which the tensions between Athens and Jerusalem remain with us today. In a sense, we remain Philo's heirs. I'm happy to have Professor Cortest on the show with us today.
Your book is fascinating and very bold in the sense that it covers a large swath of time, as well as delving deeply into philosophic topics in different contexts, in the Greek context, in Egypt, in which Philo lived, in the Muslim Jewish context in which Maimonides lived, and the scholastic Christian context in which Aquinas lived. And before we get into the book itself and the way in which you chose to structure the book, I would like to begin with a little bit of a background question, and that is to discuss Philo himself. The book is titled Philo's Heirs, and in a sense, although much of the book is about a comparison between Maimonides and Aquinas, you deal at length with Philo and the legacy of his thought. So who was Philo, and why is he important to medieval philosophy?
Philo was a Jewish philosopher in the Platonic tradition, sometimes called a Middle Platonist, because he comes in that period, the period where we find a number of very important philosophers during really the great age of Alexandria. Philo himself lives from approximately the year 25 before our era, and about to the year about 50. Afterwards, so he's living really during the age of Jesus, the apostles, and Paul. He's a Jew who lives in Alexandria, which is really the great center for the diaspora and is a great center for Jewish life. And Philo himself inherits the great traditions of the philosophers that have come before him, the great traditions in Greek philosophy. He's familiar with those traditions. He's also familiar with Roman philosophy, the philosophy of people who live at about the same time in Rome. He has a great philosophical knowledge. What makes Philo, though, especially interesting to me, and I would hope to others, is that he's really the first of the great philosophers who is able to bring his knowledge of Greek philosophy to bear on sacred texts, the Hebrew Bible. He reads with that kind of knowledge, with that kind of training, so that he's able to interpret biblical texts from a philosophical point of view that's very sophisticated. And after his time, the way he reads, that method he uses for interpretation is used for century after century after century, mostly by Christians. From early on, the time of Clement of Alexandria, the time of some of the other philosophers from that age, we already have Christians following in his tradition, using his method. Maybe it's possible that not as many Jews early on followed this tradition, but that philosophy, that method of doing philosophy, the way he does it, is later picked up in the Middle Ages by philosophers of the tradition of the Kalam, the Islamic scholastic philosophers, the Mutakallimun, but also many Islamic, many Christian philosophers. And I think my thesis in the book is that Maimonides, the great Jewish philosopher, who dies early in the 13th century, in method, at least, in his perhaps most famous philosophical book, the Morei Nevuchim, the Guide for the Perplexed, follows the same method. He addresses many of the same questions as Philo. He uses a method similar to Philo's. And then later, of course, Thomas Aquinas, the greatest of the Christian scholastics, who dies in 1274, takes up many of the same questions in his works, the two Summae. He also is... Thomas discusses natural law, divine providence, prophecy, and many other issues in the same way that we see the questions addressed by Philo.
Before we get into the specific topics, as you mentioned, you've picked five themes, sort of a curriculum or a certain set of questions that Philo set up and that Aquinas and Maimonides deal with explicitly. Let's return to what you mentioned about method. You write in the introduction to your book that, in effect, Philo taught Christian writers how to read allegorically and how to use the language and methods of philosophy to explicate Christian doctrine. So how did he do this, and can you give us some examples of his allegorical reading?
Before the time of Philo, people who employed a kind of philosophical reading to read, let's say, Homer, allegorical reading, that is looking for a second level. This sort of thing existed before Philo. What Philo does, though, is he takes that method that already exists, and he applies it to Hebrew Bible so that he can take, for example, episodes from the life of Moses, from the Moses we know from Scripture, and explain things philosophical, or explain how Moses has a philosophical of understanding of law, of all things, really. In fact, for Philo, Moses is a model of philosophical understanding. He doesn't see him as a someone who is not philosophical, who doesn't understand things philosophically. In fact, he's in a way the perfect philosopher, because he not only understands the law, he not only is the master of law, he's the greatest prophet. He's gifted in a way no other prophet is, because of his direct relationship with God. He also is a leader of his people, so he's the embodiment of the philosophical leader. He's all these things. And I would say that just reading like Philo's Life of Moses, you get the feeling that he understands every episode in Moses' life is an example of philosophical understanding.
One of the points you bring out again and again in the book, but let's talk about it at least now with regards to Philo, is about the sort of standard philosophic topics that he explicates. And in the book, you outline five that you focus on. So we said prophecy and creation, natural law, divine providence, and divine attributes. If we were to place Philo in his context, can you point out the ways in which at that time what he was doing was unique? Who was he in dialogue with at the time that he was writing?
That's a really good question. And you have to ask, well, who would the people have been? Who would his readers have been? Some of them surely would have been other Middle Platonists, that is, Platonic philosophers living at the same time. But I have a feeling that his audience is probably an audience of educated Jews who live at the same time in Alexandria. I really think this because the issues, the questions, if we think of them, the divine attributes, divine providence, prophecy, these are issues that are very important for the way Jews understand the world. Well, there are, of course, philosophical discussions of divine attributes, but it would be like within the context of let's say, Platonic philosophy, what exactly, how can we describe maybe the essence, the being of the one? But in Philo, when he talks about divine attributes, he's talking about God's divine attributes, the attributes which we would apply negatively for the most part. It's an apophatic system, that is. We know what God is by knowing what God is not. When he talks about divine attributes, he's talking about it in a theistic context, in a Jewish context. When he talks about divine providence in the same way, it's in a Jewish sense. I strongly defend the idea that Philo was a Jewish philosopher, that he understood things as a Jew, that his Jewishness is part of his philosophy. It shapes all his philosophy.
You set out in your chapters about Philo to argue this point. I mean, it's something that in Philo scholarship is greatly debated. Here was a Jew living in Alexandria who wrote in Greek. How much Hebrew did he know? How Jewish was he? And one of the questions that your book seeks to answer, in a sense, is as much about Aquinas and Maimonides as it is about Philo, in the sense that although Philo, for example, in the case of Maimonides, was not quoted explicitly, you argue very strongly and in a subtle way that it doesn't take explicit references to show the influence. And you show the way in which he set up not only a method of reading, but also these series of topics that come up again and again that he set the agenda for. Returning back to Philo himself, before we continue on with Maimonides and Aquinas, your argument is that Philo is really a Jew and should be seen as writing, in a sense, for a Jewish audience. What was his reception among Christians, among the church fathers who sort of lived between his period and the period under discussion in the High Middle Ages? So what was his reception among Christians? Did they perceive him as Jewish? And how were they able to adapt this sort of Jewish thinking, I guess, or this synthesis between monotheistic thinking and Greek philosophy?
Well, I think it's a really it's a special question because really, I think, quite honestly, after St. Jerome talked the way he did about Philo, he sort of Christianizes Philo. I'm sure that there were many Christian thinkers who believed that Philo was actually a Christian or that Philo had accepted Christianity. I think this is a common view for a long, long time, so that they're not really in their minds, some of the early Christian thinkers, adopting so much the thinking of a Jew or thinking that is Jewish as much as they are accepting or adopting a system that's developed in the beginning by this thinker who was probably Jewish in the beginning but converted to Christianity. And I don't think that's unusual. I think we see this kind of interpretation of Jewish thinkers for centuries after Philo. You know, it's believed, oh, this thinker was surely a Christian, or he's surely converted. And of course, a great authority like Jerome, when Jerome tells us that Philo actually, you know, had converted to Christianity, this is that would be enough for many, many Christian thinkers to say, yes, this is the truth about Philo. Of course, historically, there's no evidence that Philo ever converted to Christianity.
Right. I mean, I guess what you would come to then is the way in which Philo was rediscovered as a Jew. Or really, I mean, maybe in a bolder sense, what your book is about is the type of the ways in which this is more universal than specific to either Jews or Christians or Greeks or Romans. I guess one question that may be interesting to people and certainly is interesting to me, particularly after reading the book and sort of force of the argument, is the question of why Philo was forgotten. I mean, here is somebody who wrote prolifically, who had a wide influence at his time on Christians and on Jews ultimately, and set up such an interesting and unique way of thinking. One would imagine that he would have been more famous today than he is. So what do you attribute this sort of forgetting of Philo, and particularly in not placing Philo in this genealogy as sort of a forefather of medieval philosophy?
I'm going to try to be bold in my answer. I think that with the advent of really rabbinic Judaism, Judaism in some ways takes there's a different approach. It's more, I suppose, limited to a Jewish context, and the way rabbinic writers write is not the same as the way Philo writes. In fact, I think that Philo's kind of philosophy, his language is clearly not the language of rabbinic Judaism. He's very much in the not in, in the subjects he touches upon, but in method, he's very much a Greek philosopher. Also, really, Philo, as I said before, perhaps in different words, is adopted and embraced by Christians even far more than by Jews. It's also important to think that Philo, as you stated before, may not have been that knowledgeable about Hebrew. I mean, the Hebrew Bible he knows is in Greek. You know, it's the Greek version. It's the text he knows. And if you look at the Greek explanation, the Greek beginning, I should say, of in Genesis of creation, the explanation of creation, and then you look at Plato's Timaeus, the language is very similar. So Philo is very Greek. He's working in a Greek tradition, but he is Jewish, and his subjects are Jewish. But he's more in line with Greek philosophy in terms of method, and also as I think Jewish thinking to a large extent with rabbinic Judaism maybe takes a different direction, and there's probably some suspicion of the Greek tradition, which, as we know, for the most part, is a tradition that is, of course, not a tradition that embraces revealed religion at all, and it's even in many instances hostile to revealed religion.
And in terms of the scholarship today over the last 200 years, why do you think, or how do you think, really, Philo has been thought of as this figure? I mean, you open up the book with talking about Harry Wolfson, who wrote an influential book on Philo and tried to create this sort of narrative where Philo was the beginnings of medieval philosophy. But his voice is, in a sense, a lone voice. So the intervention that you're trying to make in echoing Wolfson and rethinking about Philo and his influence on medieval philosophy is an intervention. And why do you see that intervention is necessary? Why was he not somebody who was remembered and thought of more highly?
That you have a philosopher who, in the West, unfortunately, the philosophers who have been studied traditionally have been really the giants, so that you have, if people only study philosophy from the point of view of the old manuals of philosophy, the traditional way that Western philosophy was taught, You have Plato, and there's a long discussion of Socrates, but Plato and his works, which we have so many preserved, and then, of course, Aristotle. You have all that tradition, and then typically people jump to Plotinus. This is just the way it was traditionally done, and you sort of skip that middle group. And then when it comes to the Middle Ages, they skip centuries. And then they go maybe to the period of high scholasticism. They may or may not include Maimonides. And then they jump to Aquinas and they move on further. And then they come right to Descartes. I mean, I don't think I'm wrong if I'm saying this is the way many, many, many people studied philosophy. And now it's probably worse because they probably study even less history than before. Now it's just philosophy of language. But getting back to the question of Philo, Philo's kind of, he's not Plato, he's not Aristotle, he's a little different. He comes at a time when we think there probably weren't any great philosophers. My argument would be that actually the one who shaped the way philosophy was done until the time of Spinoza was Philo. And the person who said this and wrote about this and inspired me to write about it was Harry Wolfson. Harry Wolfson was this giant in the U.S. who taught at Harvard. He was really the first professor of Judaic studies in the U.S. Certainly he was the first director of any kind of big Judaic studies program. But this is a man who had a tremendous background. He studied as a young man in a yeshiva. He had come to the U.S. fairly young. He then went straight to Harvard. He went straight through Harvard, got a PhD, never left Harvard. He was the... except for military service, he was a lifelong Harvard scholar, and his work that work on Philo, I think first published in about 1934, Foundations of Religious Philosophy in Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, and that's a masterpiece. He knew the medieval writers, he knew the ancients, he knew Greek. And his argument about Philo being the one who taught the West a method of philosophy that survived until the time of Spinoza, that's a very, very bold claim. But my book really, the whole point of my book really is to argue that and to show with these specific examples that Wolfson's thesis was correct. Philo was the one who did show the West how to do philosophy in this way. And I think that that accomplishment is just absolutely amazing. It's also true that among people who study philosophy traditionally, there has been for a long time, maybe this is changing. This is changing in our own time, but a great prejudice against the religious philosophers, I would say. And Philo not only lives at a time when we think there are only minor figures, these middle Platonists, but he's also a religious philosopher. And in fact, I think that the truth is, he's not only one of the giants of philosophy, he's perhaps one of the greatest of all philosophical theologians. And most of all, I agree with Wolfson in his assessment of Philo's impact, that he was, in fact, the one who taught the West how to do philosophy in a method that was the method that survived, until the 17th century.
Could you bridge for us this period of time from Philo to Aquinas and Maimonides? What was the reception, I guess, in one sense of the image of Philo himself, but more particularly of his allegorical method and the certain set of questions that he set up?
If you look through the Guide for the Perplexed of Maimonides, what you see is a book in which Maimonides explains Judaism philosophically, and text after text from from scripture, from Torah, is explained philosophically. That's what Maimonides does. Maimonides understands that that's how philosophy is done, because Maimonides lives in the age of the great Islamic philosophers. He inherits their tradition, the tradition of the Kalam, Islamic scholastic philosophy. He's also an Aristotelian, but his Aristotelianism is greatly influenced by Neoplatonism. It's Neoplatonic Aristotelianism. Now, Aquinas is very similar in that he's an Aristotelian, yes, but as scholars have been showing now for 50 years, Aquinas's Aristotelianism is also greatly shaped by Neoplatonism. So neither Aquinas nor Maimonides are pure Aristotelians. They're Aristotelians with this Neoplatonic twist, but they both interpret scripture. They want to understand religion. Maimonides, Judaism, Thomas Aquinas, the Christian religion. They want to understand religion and explain religion philosophically, so that people, in case of Maimonides, maybe a young person who is perplexed, who says, "Look, I want to see how reason and religion are compatible." In Thomas Aquinas' case, he writes his great Summa for students. This is a textbook for students who are learning, who are being trained in philosophical theology. And how do they approach? Well, how do they approach their questions? They both have this Aristotelian Neoplatonic framework. The method, and they're using it, they're applying their reading to biblical texts. Because for them, biblical texts are true texts. They're expressions of truth, and they must be comprehensible philosophically. And I think in both cases, they try to explain their religions with this philosophical method, and it's the method, I say, Wolfson said, was first introduced by Philo.
Could you expand a little bit on this point about philosophy and religion as the means of understanding truth? Because I think, in a sense, this really lies at the heart of the book, and really the heart of maybe Philo's project. I think people would normally say that maybe philosophy and religion are opposed to one another in the quest for discovering truth. People might think that philosophy is able to be critical and perhaps more objective or unbiased. Or on the other hand, people might criticize philosophy on the side of religion and say, well, it doesn't deal with revealed truths or metaphysics or things of that nature. So these three thinkers, and particularly the school of Philo, the heirs of Philo that you outline, how did they think of philosophy and religion? And how was Philo able to create a synthesis between these two disciplines that people see as opposed to one another?
All you have to do is look around in our own time. People typically take philosophy seriously. That is, they think, yes, this person has a profound understanding of this or that question, this or that subject, and these philosophical proofs are very impressive. They take philosophical disputation seriously to a point, but often, very often, especially people who are trained in the academy at secular institutions, like my alma mater, the University of California, Berkeley, they don't take religion seriously at all. So they say, okay, it's okay to do philosophy, but this religious stuff, it's all a bunch of superstition. Now, for a man like Philo was not only a philosopher, he was a philosopher who took revealed religion seriously, believing that what was revealed was true, as true or more true than any philosophical question, any philosophical conclusion. So his method, his way of approaching his religion, which is dear to him, which is true, is philosophical. He wants to understand religion in a sophisticated way, in a way that shows great learning, in a way that shows profound understanding and also profound analysis. One way we show our sophistication as readers is by analyzing something very, very carefully. And Philo understood that. And when he reads biblical texts, you may not agree with his interpretation, but you have to say, what an amazing analysis. What an amazing conclusion he reaches here. Maimonides is also an incredible reader of Torah, one of the great masters, of course. And Aquinas, as a biblical commentator, is outstanding, and he understands and takes it very, very seriously. For him, what's true is revealed religion is more true than philosophy, but philosophy gives us the lexicon to talk about what is most true, which is revealed religion.
Well, let's talk about some of these issues ourselves then, and let's talk about Maimonides and Aquinas. And the ways in which you compare and contrast them in the main part of the book. So as I mentioned previously, you outline five particular sort of themes, topics that they inherit from Philo. And what you do is you sort of read Aquinas and Maimonides against or with one another. So before we get onto the specific topics, what was it about this comparison, Aquinas and Maimonides? What stood out to you? Why do you think that this comparison was necessary? And maybe just a little bit of background about both of them for people who may be new to St. Thomas Aquinas and Moses Maimonides.
Moses Maimonides is the greatest of the medieval Jewish philosophers, in my opinion. And he is really the thinker we most remember as the person who wanted to harmonize religion and philosophy. He wrote this very special book, The Guide for the Perplexed, Morei Nevuhim, where he tries to show how religion can be explained, how Judaism can be explained philosophically. Now, he's a giant, and Thomas Aquinas is really the giant among the medieval Christian philosophers. He's the greatest of the Christian scholastics. And Thomas Aquinas actually knew the Guide for the Perplexed. We know this because he does quote directly from Maimonides. He considered Maimonides a great authority, but he disagrees with Maimonides on a number of points. He speaks of Maimonides as an adversary because that's what philosophers do. They talk about the ones who have come before them, and typically what they want to do is show that what the person said before them, the philosopher who preceded them, was wrong about something, and they want to show that. I mean, if you look at Aristotle over and over and over again, this is what he does. He shows how those who preceded him were wrong. Thomas Aquinas does the same. Maimonides does the same thing. But Maimonides is the great Jewish philosopher, so great, I think, that the Jewish philosophers always look back to Maimonides. Those who have come since Maimonides always look back to Maimonides, and many of the questions that people address philosophically in that tradition go back to Maimonides, and they refer to him. In the same way, Thomas Aquinas, Thomistic thinking, the teachings of the Thomists, these are teachings that are very, very much a part of Christian theology today. People quote from Aquinas often, and he continues to be the great master of Christian theology for many people, especially the traditionalists. Thomas Aquinas knows this great work, The Guide for the Perplexed, and he often talks about Maimonides, or as he calls him often, Rabbi Moses, as a philosophical opponent. And he will disagree with Maimonides, and very much in the tradition of philosophers always. I mean, if we go back to the works of Aristotle, Aristotle always talked about his predecessors and how his philosophy is a corrective. He says, he often talks about how the people before him, the philosophers writing before him, were wrong. And, well, Maimonides, in the same way, talks about many who have come before him and how wrong they are, especially philosophers in the tradition of the Kalam, the Islamic scholastic philosophy. Thomas Aquinas also, he uses the philosophy of those who have come before him. He knows it. He studies it. And he often disagrees with people writing before his time. So they're very much alike in that way. Maimonides is the master of Jewish philosophy, who for centuries after his time is still considered the master for many. And he's certainly a philosopher that any serious Jewish philosopher for several centuries after his time had to take on as one of the required opponents. Thomas Aquinas has shaped the way Christian theologians do philosophy for centuries and centuries. There are many people who now would say perhaps that they reject the teachings of Thomas Aquinas, but Thomas Aquinas's theological ideas are still very much a part of especially Roman Catholic thinking, but also Anglican thinking. And Christian philosophers in general, if they're serious about the history of Christian philosophy, have to address questions raised by Thomas Aquinas.
The first theme that you outline in your book as a theme that was raised by Philo and then came under discussion by both Maimonides and Aquinas is the question of divine attributes. And this is a central question to many medieval theologians and philosophers. So I guess, first of all, what are divine attributes and how does Philo raise this as a topic? And then I guess the follow-up question is about Maimonides and Aquinas. How did they receive Philo's conception of divine attributes?
Well, first of all, if I say that Maimonides or Thomas Aquinas received a teaching from Philo, I want to make this clear, it's indirect, right? They're not quoting directly from Philo, but if one looks at Philo's discussion of the divine attributes and if one studies how he approaches this whole question through the via negativa, that is, we understand the divine attributes by knowing what God is not, by talking in a way that enables us to understand how we're not to talk about God, the attributes that don't belong to God. It's this way of talking about God, the apophatic tradition. Philo really is one of the great masters of that tradition, and the way he does this is his whole discussion of divine attributes, negative attributes, says God is not this, God is not that, God is not this. You understand that this discussion has tremendous resonance and has a tremendous impact, especially on early Christian thinkers who approach the question in the same way. And that divine attributes discussion, which we find in Philo, we find over and over and over again in Christian writers in the Middle Ages. And then, of course, Maimonides picks up the same question and he handles it in much the same way, which makes me wonder if maybe there were some links between Maimonides and Philo we don't know about, texts where we can't be sure about. In the case of Thomas Aquinas, he talks about divine attributes in the same way. Again, via negativa, we know that he quotes from the church fathers, and that those church fathers, many of these church fathers knew about Philo's discussion and knew about Philo's approach.
Another one of the themes that you see as continuing from Philo through to Aquinas and Maimonides is the question of divine providence, God's role or influence on the world, either directly or indirectly. And that's something that had great interest to Jews, Christians, Muslims, from antiquity all the way to the early modern and modern periods. What was Philo's position on this? And how do you set that against Maimonides and Aquinas? How did they see divine providence? And how do you see this as being influenced by Philo?
Divine providence is really a theme that is addressed in a very sophisticated way by philosophers like Seneca. You'll find in Roman philosophy, in the Stoics, a lot of discussion about divine providence. What makes Philo different is that he understands God in a different way. He understands the God. He understands God as the God of Abraham, the God of Moses, the God of Isaac. He's talking about God in terms of the God we know from the Bible, from Scripture. It's not, he doesn't have just an abstract notion of the one or some abstract notion of some being with whom no text is connected. There's no revealed religion in the discussions of divine providence we find before Philo, or even in Philo's time outside the Jewish world. Philo's the one talking about divine providence. Well, he's talking about divine providence in a way that a Jew would understand divine providence, or a Christian would understand divine providence, but he's talking about it philosophically, which adds another dimension. Also, that discussion of divine providence and how it is to be understood philosophically has a long history, and you find one philosopher after another talking about this question. In fact, a good example is one of the classics of medieval philosophy is Boethius. Boethius, contrasting divine providence with fortuna, fortune, says, "Fortuna is what we see." This is we as human beings living on earth. We as human beings, we see what looks like chaos all around us. Divine providence, divina providentia, is what God sees. And there is order. It is all order. That distinction is very, very important in medieval philosophy. Maimonides has to talk about divine providence. One of the things he needs to address is, well, why do bad things happen to good people? Right? This is a very important question in any discussion of divine providence. And Aquinas, of course, again, takes up the question of divine providence, and he has the whole history of philosophy right at his fingertips, and he can talk about it as Boethius does. Boethius is a very, very important source for Thomas, but he can talk about it as the way the Stoics do. Again, that Latin philosophy is very important. Roman, Latin, Stoic philosophy is very important for Aquinas. He talks about divine providence in that way, but he also talks about divine providence, again, within the context of revealed religion. So Philo, Maimonides, and Thomas all talk about divine providence, but not just in some abstract way, and in a way that's connected with revealed religion.
The final theme I want to touch on today is chapter 7 in your book, and that's on natural law. And I imagine that people who are interested in natural law either see a very modern genealogy for it, or see a genealogy that goes back to Roman law and to the Stoics. What you present here is something I think that's very challenging to that, seeing the source for a lot of concepts in natural law, and particularly those concepts that are brought out in Maimonides and Aquinas, you see them sourced in Philo. So beginning with Philo, what was his conception of natural law, and why was it so original? And then how do you see this in comparison with the scholastic natural law and the natural law that's suggested by Maimonides and Aquinas?
Well, when you see the way Philo talks about natural law, he talks about the Essenes and the way they live, the values they embrace, and so on. It's clearly a discussion of natural law. That is, law in a very philosophical sense, in which it's not, that law is not based on, it's neither based on custom nor is it based on tradition, but rather based on a natural way of seeing how things fit together, how things work together in a natural way in the world in which we live. And Philo talks about this in a way that's very different. And to my mind, he should be considered one of the greatest of all defenders of natural law. It's curious that you do have discussions of natural law. I mean, think of Sophocles and of course, Antigone, where we clearly see, you know, references to a law that is natural, that is beyond the laws that are written. There is a place in the Nicomachean Ethics where Aristotle also mentions again a law that is a law that is not written, that's the law beyond the law. But the way Philo talks about natural law with very clear examples and bringing out the implications of what natural law would, how a community that embraced natural law would live, would act, is very, very impressive and very different and very original. And I think in that way, he's one of the great founders of natural law tradition. Of course, Maimonides is medieval. He has a whole series of different traditions that come before him, and he can talk about natural law also within those philosophical traditions, but he can also talk about the Noahide laws that, where he says, and there are laws even in our own teachings as Jews, there are laws that are applicable to all people, not just to Jews. These are the laws that form a foundation of what I would call a Jewish natural law. And so he can point specifically to that point and talk about those laws in a way that clearly constitutes a discussion of natural law tradition. Thomas Aquinas, even though his the section in the Summa on natural law is really very short, that discussion is the foundation for all subsequent discussions of natural law tradition, really in Christian circles. He is the master of natural law, even though, as I say, the section in the Summa is very short, where he talks about law in general, and then the short section on natural law, just a few questions, but he really lays out the philosophical foundation for natural law, where he has this long discussion of the difference between the speculative intellect and the practical intellect. The speculative understands things from a purely philosophical point of view. The practical intellect has to include discussions of how we are to act. There, within that tradition, we find this wonderful discussion of natural law in Thomas. And of course, for him, the practical intellect is informed by the speculative intellect. And I talk about all of this in that section of the book.
To conclude, can you give us a hint as to what the afterlife of this tradition is? Were there further heirs of Philo after Maimonides and Aquinas? How did people understand Maimonides and Aquinas in relationship to Philo? We know that during the Renaissance there was a renewed interest in Philo. And I'm interested in the ways in which you see the setup, the narrative that you've presented playing out after the High Middle Ages.
Yes. There's no question, because in the same way that Maimonides as a philosopher survives, the debates that the Jews would have about Maimonides long after Maimonides was gone are a clear indication of the fact that the philosophical tradition of Maimonides survives. Thomas Aquinas' philosophical teachings are addressed over and over and over again. His discussion of natural law is the discussion that inspires the debates in the 16th century about whether or not native peoples are human beings, whether or not this is the the debate at Valladolid in Spain, 1551, about whether or not, as Bartolomé de las Casas said, the native peoples are human beings and they should be treated as human beings, and the societies in which they live should be considered legitimate societies, and we do not have the right to conquer these peoples or to enslave them. That whole discussion is a natural law discussion that comes from Thomas Aquinas. Maimonides, of course, is the philosopher that for Jewish tradition is the one whose ideas are challenged from his time forward. And of course, what Wolfson argued was that Philo's way of doing philosophy survived until the time of time of Spinoza. Now, the reason he says that is because it was Spinoza himself who decided to break with that tradition. So it was Spinoza who addresses Maimonides. He says he disagrees with Maimonides on so many questions. He takes a different turn. And for Wolfson, who is the inspiration for me in a way for the book, really, Spinoza is this very, very, very important figure in the history of Western philosophy, perhaps as important or more than René Descartes. Certainly the same set of topics is a set of topics that will continue to at least the year 1600. And I think the method, the allegorical method, the allegorical way of interpreting scripture is, of course, of profound importance for philosophers up into the 17th century. So I think Philo's method, Philo's topics, the method and the topics survived for centuries after the High Middle Ages, but also the teachings of Maimonides survive. Jewish thinkers after Maimonides again and again and again go back to Maimonides and address questions that Maimonides addressed, which are, I say, fall within this Philonic tradition. And of course, Thomas Aquinas is the master of Christian theology for centuries and centuries and centuries. And Christian theologians after the time of Aquinas will go back to Aquinas over and over and over again. And they'll talk about things like natural law very much in the tradition of Thomas Aquinas. So of course, this has a long afterlife. And I think part of what I wanted to do, my project, was to see if Wolfson's thesis was right about Maimonides and was right regarding Philo. That is, that Philo and the way Philo taught us to do philosophy, the way Philo led the way in terms of this philosophical discussion of revealed religion, held true in the time of Maimonides and Aquinas. And my conclusion is that it absolutely did hold true in that time. And if I had continued with a second volume of the book, I would have shown how philosophers after Maimonides and Aquinas up to about the year 1600 continued in the very same tradition.
I would like to conclude by thanking Professor Luis Cortes for joining us on New Books in Jewish Studies. We've been talking about his book, Philo's Errors, Moses Maimonides and Thomas Aquinas, published by Academic Studies Press in 2017.